Welcome to episode 49 of Frank Reactions, the show where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name's Tema Frank. I got a delightful email last week from one of our listeners, Marie Gervais, who wrote, "Hi Tema, I just finished listening to the interview with Vic Mirag from Unstoppable Conversations. This is actually my favorite interview of all the interviews you've done on your podcast. I do think it is fundamentally different from what much change management literature is saying, mainly because it goes to the heart of what it means to be a human being and what motivates people from the inside in a non-contrived way. Thanks for the excellent interview, Marie." Well, Marie, thank you for giving your feedback. I really appreciate it. It does my heart good when people actually take the time to send me their feedback. So thank you. For the past couple of years, I've been looking really hard to find great examples of companies that had a major corporate turnaround based really on changing customer experience. And today I'm bringing you a story from one such company. When Susan Miller, the woman I interview in today's episode, walked into this company as its new president, it was ranked 7 or 8 in market share, had a reputation as being just the box movers as opposed to the competitors who had this high-end, knowledgeable quality image, and had a lot of customers who hadn't been that happy with the customer service they'd been getting. After doing some preliminary market research, it became obvious to Sue that the real issue was turning around service. And she discovered through the process that if you do a great recovery after having messed up, you'll actually be even further ahead in loyalty with that individual than you would have been if you had never screwed up at all. Not to suggest that you should be messing up. Try not to. But if you have, all is not lost. In fact, we had a similar conversation with this a while back, the episode with Johnny Russo in episode 19 of Frank Reactions. So if you want to hear that one, you can go listen to it at frankreactions.com/19, the number 19. In today's episode, you'll hear how she managed to turn that around and get the company to go from $20 million in revenues to $500 million over the course of just 7 years. And to do that due to a better customer service model. Chat with you briefly at the end of the interview.
I'm Sue Miller. I was the president of a company called Soft Sell Canada. And during that growth period, we did an acquisition which changed the company name to Maricel Canada.
And when you came into the company, how long had it been around?
Soft Sell Canada had been around for, I don't know, less than 5 years. SoftSell US was fairly well established, so we were a subsidiary operation of an American-based worldwide corporation.
Okay. And when you came in, what were some of the things that you saw in terms of challenges for the company?
Well, the company had not been making money for its entire life. Sometimes it would make money 1 month and then lose money. When we looked at our relative size to our competitors, we were a distant 7 or 8 in market share. And I'm not even sure at that point if the third-party survey instrument, which was run by Computer Dealer News, I'm not even sure if they acknowledged us. That's how small we were.
What did you decide to do? What were your priorities when you took charge?
The first thing I did is meet with the largest accounts. I would meet with the person who was in charge of the buying decision. And I would ask them what their challenges were and what their future direction were, not relative to buying from us, but relative to their business overall. What did they see evolving out in the marketplace? What did they think they needed to be doing in order to be prepared for that? And then based on that information, and then I would, of course, always ask, you know, what could we do in order to help you achieve your objectives?
And tell me a bit more about what the products were that you sold.
We carried 35,000 different computer products. So we carried all software. We also carried, when I joined, we carried hardware peripherals. And again, as we grew the company, we became also people who carried the actual computers, okay. Laptops and PCs.
And so what you were carrying were very standardized products.
Yeah, there were very few things that we carried that were not available from a competitor, you know, competitive distribution company. And that was the key.
So what were the reasons why people would have chosen your company as opposed to the competitor?
Well, that was what was so interesting in the conversation. It became very clear to me that we were a service company and our competitors were focusing on the product and the price. And we started to focus on what are the services that a dealer would expect, because this was a business to business sale. So what were the things that influenced their purchasing decisions? And it turned out to be, you know, things about being able to place an order really easily, knowing that the delivery is going to happen on time, that we're carrying what they need them to carry, that we help them sell that product. Mm. And so we started to focus on those things.
So that would have been a significant cultural shift?
Yeah, very much so. In fact, I think when I first joined the company, I'm not a computer guru in any
way. What is your background, Susan?
Oh, I'm trained in accounting.
Okay.
And they had to forgive me for that. I'm trained in accounting and I have a real instinct and have worked for a long time in sales and marketing. But the accounting training really helped because when you're carrying so many SKUs, you have to keep track of an awful lot of information to know what's going on. And so that helped me tremendously. But at any rate, in talking to the customers, it became apparent that the very large shops needed us to position ourselves to really enable them to do good purchasing and, you know, meet the customer demands and carry as little stock as possible. And the mm-hmm. little guys, you know, the 5,000 other customers, they were really looking for same-day shipment and, and you know, the feeling that they could get a hold of us really quickly if they needed to. So, again, they didn't need to carry stock.
Okay, so you concluded that the way to approach this was, I guess, to be reasonably competitive on price, but to really focus on service.
Exactly.
So how did you start the process then of making this change internally?
Well, the first thing I did is I hired, and I can't remember their names anymore, it was a while ago, I hired a third-party organization that was customer service-oriented. And so they mm-hmm. came in and they, you know, basically laid out for me how we would survey our customers, the kinds of things that we would ask about. And then once we had conducted the surveys, they were tremendously helpful in helping us understand, okay, what are the areas in the feedback that are important to pay attention to? Mm-hmm. And they also offered us a service recovery system. So one of the more surprising things that I learned in this exercise was that if a customer bought from us all the time and we did a good job of service, they'd be a pretty loyal customer. But if a customer bought from us and we messed up on the service and then we recovered quickly enough, that customer is actually more loyal than the guy we never messed up with.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you give me an example of the sorts of recovery, like what sort of situation?
Yeah. Well, let's say we ship the wrong product mm-hmm. and the customer calls us and say, you know, you shipped the wrong product. The fact that we apologize, immediately send them the right product, and maybe we give them a credit towards their next purchase, just a small one, you know, just something to acknowledge that we created an inconvenience.
Right.
And we even had a program where we would ship before they ship, you know, again, a trust program. They say it's the wrong product. You say, we're going to ship you the right one right away, and we're going to credit you for the old product and just send it back to us. So we're not waiting for the return, you know?
Yeah, so showing that you really trust them.
Yeah, and that it's our fault.
Yeah, exactly. So that really then started to build some support against people who perhaps hadn't been that happy with your organization before.
Exactly. We were known in the industry as the box movers. Our competitors, you know, had this high-end, high-quality tech support, and they had the established view in the marketplace that they really knew all about these products. And that we didn't know anything about the products. And, you know, therefore, you know, it wasn't a good idea to buy from us. But the realities were that people buy from distribution. Usually they know what product they want to buy. And they're buying from distribution because they need the fulfillment service that distribution provides. So we just really focused there. Now, we didn't eliminate tech support, but we made tech support something that was staged so that the customer that bought more from us received a higher level of tech support than the customer that bought less. And, you know, we didn't make it obvious to the customer. We brought in a very sophisticated telephone system where we could recognize the client call, their phone number, that could tie to the database of how much they bought from us, and that would cue the call to the right rep.
So those who were bigger customers got a more advanced level of service.
Exactly. They also got priority on all call levels, like whether they're calling for service or they're calling for sales. If one of their calls came in and there were 12 calls in the queue, they would be number one, no matter what they called in.
Right. That makes sense. Now, when we were talking, one of the things that I found really intriguing was you mentioned that at first you thought, okay, well, let's just give frontline staff total freedom to make things right for customers. And that didn't work quite the way you had expected. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, we, as part of the service recovery program, the idea was that the frontline people could repair whatever it was that we had blown. And so we thought, okay, great, we'll just give them authority to fix it. And what we found is that our frontline team actually said, please don't do that. Because they wanted a certain band. It was like, okay, I'm prepared to make that decision for $40, but I'm not prepared to make that decision for $400. And also they felt that as frontline, the customer could really bully them. And they needed to be able to say, well, let me go check with my supervisor. Right. And I'll get the best deal that I can. So that really mattered. And that was a surprise to me. But the whole service recovery program was an interesting thing in that, you know, the minute that it was reported by the customer, our customer service reps would then give it to the frontline salesperson. And only if the frontline salesperson could not manage it, then it would move up. And there were a certain number of days that it had to move all the way up the ranks to me. Like, it had to be resolved within 5 days.
Right.
The frontline had a day, and then they'd move it to the supervisors, and we'd move up. Because we had research that indicated that service recovery had a lot to do with timing. So the customer would be more loyal to you, but not if they had to climb over 5 miles of broken glass and wait 3 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So how often did things end up all the way up to you?
Very rarely. Because I also empowered my assistant.
All right.
Right? So very rarely would anything get all the way up to me. And that was a bit of an indication that we were, you know, we're talking about the repair of a service recovery. But the realities also were that we focused every quarter, we got our top 35 people together. And we focused on what are the problems that keep recurring and how do we fix them. So we didn't just let those problems go. So that it got, as time went on, we made less and less of those errors.
You say your top 35 people. How many staff did you have overall?
We had about 850.
Okay. And were they in multiple locations across the country?
Yes, we had offices in Montreal and Vancouver, as well as Toronto. And we had two facilities in Toronto. We had the office staff and we had a huge dedicated warehouse.
So you say you got people together once a month to look at, you know, what needed to be changed so that these problems didn't recur. To change processes internally, one of the things that I've seen or heard quite often is you've got different silos internally who are reluctant to look at a common vision. Was that an issue at all?
Well, that's where that 35 people come in. So my direct reports were 7 or 8 people. And we would get together initially and prioritize what are the things we're seeing that we think are the most important things for the company to address in the upcoming quarter. And it was once a quarter that we got together. And then we would have a meeting right the next day with their direct reports. So one level down. And that's where we got to 35.
Okay.
And so we would all agree in a group of 35, we would walk through, here's what's going on with the business. Here we are with our sales. Here's what's happening with our service recovery issues. You know, what's going on with the margins, whatever, what the business issues are. And here as a group, we've done the heavy lifting, the top team, and we've figured out what we think the top priorities are. However, we want to vet them with you. So what do you think? And so we would put them up on the wall and sometimes they got changed. And so then we all were united as a group on what we were going to fix. And then we asked somebody to champion each of those priorities, one of which at least would be a service recovery issue. And the person who championed it was a volunteer. Often they weren't a manager. And they would then call on who they needed from the team to fix this problem. So it was always a cross-organizational team. It was very rare that that would be a single department.
Right. Now, walking into an organization and trying to transform the culture in that way, you were bound to have met with some resistance from people who didn't want to change the way things had been done. Mm-hmm. Did you? And how did you deal with that?
I did. I think the biggest challenge was when we acquired that other company. So we were doing about $120 million at the time, and we acquired a company that was doing $200 million. And this was the company, you know, kind of established in Canada as the number one, and they were the guys that did it the old-fashioned way, and they had huge margins. And we anticipated that the gross profit margins would be coming down, and that to continue to do business the way they did business was just going to bankrupt us. So there was quite a cultural difficulty. So we did we did engage, again, a third-party merger integration organization, and we did put together teams where, you know, half of the team would be from one organization and half from the other in each of the departments. And then they would present to kind of the executive team, which was mainly me, what they proposed, how they're going to put the things together. And when that proposal made sense, and we could see which of the two actually had a better handle on it, that would be the person who would end up leading that group. But when that proposal didn't make any sense, in the case of sales, it didn't make any sense. I ended up letting go both the VP of sales and running the sales group directly at the president level for several months until I could find the right person.
Wow. Okay. And was that right person someone internal or external?
It was external, as it turns out. But the sales, when they were running directly, with when we had the vice president of sales in place, we were growing at 15% per annum. And during the 6 months while I was in search for a vice president of sales, we grew 45% per annum.
So, wow.
Yeah, so having those, the directors of sales, of which there were about seven, direct report into me, really helped me get a handle on what was going on in that group, really empower that group. So by the time I brought in an individual, they already had the culture and the empowerment necessary.
So do you remember what some of the things were that they did differently from when they had had these VPs of sales above them?
Well, one of the things that we did was we had an individual in charge of pricing. We had a lot of data coming in, competitive data on pricing. And again, there was a huge amount of product. But we also stratified it. So we knew that, you know, the top 5% or 10% of our revenues were coming from X number of SKUs. And that, you know, we had to be really competitive on those, that those are the things that people price checked. And then as you move down in volume, you could be a little more, get a little more generous with your gross profit margin. So that was a very complex model that we developed to track the sales history. And so when I was leading the sales organization, prior to that, the VP of sales would approve all major deals. So anything off book, you know, anything that was different than the published price. Right. And I eliminated that entirely because that's not an empowered model. So what we did was the pricing guy was in charge. So the first time somebody came to me and said, well, we have this major deal with this account and it's this many hundreds of thousands of dollars and we really need you to, you know, understand it and approve it. I just looked at them and said, who's in charge of pricing? And they said, Doug. And I said, well, go talk to Doug. You guys know, here's your objective. You know, we need this much gross profit dollars this quarter. And you're going to have to put together the deals that deliver that. And Doug can help you because he really understands what's going on with pricing.
Okay. So pushing the decision-making back to where it belongs.
Yeah, back to the guy that had all the information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to make that decision, I would have had to engage him anyway. So let him make it, you know.
So what were the things that you found hardest about this whole situation?
I think that it can be very lonely at the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though you're having a really empowered organization, I think that, you know, I was a young enough manager because I was I was in my mid 30s.
Okay.
That I wasn't all that, I didn't do enough self-care and I committed quite a few hours. It took me a long time actually to cut back my hours. During the time that I was leading this organization, I would say the first 7 of the 9 years, I worked a lot, really a lot of hours, empowerment or not. And that had a lot to do with my feeling of security, I think. Right. And then in the last 2 years in Canada, I really cut those hours back. And once I went over to Europe, then I worked a pretty standard week, 40, 50 hours with, and in Europe, you take, you know, 8 weeks off holidays. So.
Yeah. Yeah, they get that balancing a little better than we do, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know the phrase, in Canada, we live to work, and in Europe, they work to live.
Yeah, exactly. But looking back at it now, had you had more experience or more self-confidence, do you think you could have done it with fewer hours in those earlier years?
For sure.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, having done it in Europe and having done it the last 2 years. The early stages, no. I think when you first come in as a leader in a turnaround situation, you do not have the staff to delegate to.
Right.
Right.
And if you want to move with speed, like the way I explained it to you, you know, the CEO in the U.S., because he was very concerned when I first joined the company and it started taking off like a bullet. he was very concerned that I wasn't going to last the night, you know, Norma Vincent, St. Phil kind of stuff, you know, candle burning at both ends.
Yeah.
But for
yeah.
me, it just felt to me like we had this huge opportunity. It was like money on the table. Not to take it. I just couldn't not take it. You know, I had to do what we needed to do. But, you know, I think after the first year or two, and during the merger, it did take a lot more time. So probably after the first 2 years, and if we had allowed a year of the merger, probably the hours could have been a lot better. And I would have probably been, you know, a happier person as a result.
So what was your background that got you to that job in the first place? I mean, that's a pretty powerful kind of position. How did you end up there? Just what briefly was your career trajectory?
It's really interesting. I was an accountant, and I came up to the idea that I really didn't like accounting. and that, you know, I thought I was going to be a member of the management team. I was going to make a big difference. You know, I was going to help them make decisions. But basically, they just most of the time saw me as a bean counter. I mean, all you got to do is tell them what they did in the past. You really couldn't help with today's decisions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the computer had come in, and I saw some ads for Apple Computer, and I decided that, this sounded really interesting. And I could see how it would sell into an accounting organization first and foremost with the spreadsheets. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven when I saw my first spreadsheet, by the way.
Yep.
And so I thought, gee, I can sell these things. And I've always been in sales. My mother ran a ladies' retail store, and I was selling from the time that I was 13. So I thought, well, I can do sales, you know, that use my accounting knowledge. And so I applied to several organizations and had, this was in the 1980, I think 1982 or 83. So it was kind of a tough time. And people said I wasn't going to get a job because, you know, I was a supervisor, you know, yippee. I was never going to get back to that level after having a baby. anyway, so when I applied, I got job offers because they were largely commissioned sales positions.
Right.
And I had one from NCR, I think it was, NRC, right. NCR, National Cash Register. Yeah. But the one I took was with a very early stage startup company that had made a single board multi-user computer, which back then was a big freaking deal. And I thought, well, this is great. I can learn a lot about computers. And I did, in fact, pretty successfully sell the product, but they were never able to manufacture it. They couldn't get it beyond the wire board stage. Mm. But they had this distribution business that I was running on the side. And so they promoted me to do that. And they promoted me to controller and general manager. Now we're talking big titles and small company, right? It's like eight people or something. Yeah. And that computer product distributor had a product called Tallgrass. And the computer product distributor is actually in difficulty. They were going bankrupt, basically. And I decided that I would stay and try and help turn them around because I had nothing to lose. You know, if it worked, that would be amazing experience. And if it didn't work, it really... I'd done the best I could and I would learn a lot.
Right.
So I proposed splitting the company in two, breaking out the manufacturing from the distributor, and the original investors in that company actually is an original investor in VisiCorp. You may not remember that company. Peter Jennings. So he still had his hands in Waterloo at that point. Mm-hmm. And I made the proposal that we would spin off a separate distribution company, and basically, the board just said, great, you'd be the president. And then they kept saying a bunch of other things that I didn't hear. Because I hadn't expected that. I fell off my chair. And I said, okay, great. And then we approached Tallgrass for a joint venture at the suggestion of one of the board members, frankly. And Tallgrass embraced it immediately, and they wanted 50%. So I became president of Tallgrass Canada as a result. And we grew that company to $10 million in its first year, which very profitable.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and then Tallgrass kind of did its early stage implosion around 1985 or 86. And I joined Softcell in 1988.
Okay.
And again, so I had built the credibility to lead a distribution company based on the work that I did with Tallgrass and the distribution company before. It was very early stage in the computer industry, so there were very few people who had the business knowledge. Everybody thought it was about knowing about the computers, and I always felt it was about knowing the business elements and sales and marketing.
Oh my God, I remember trying to buy my first couple of computers back in those days. It was such a nightmare because the people who worked even in the computer stores didn't know how to talk to regular humans.
Exactly.
The first time that we hired somebody to sell the Tallgrass product, they showed me how they sold it. And they showed that what they did is they put it up front, they showed the screen, and then they showed how to configure it. Shouldn't we maybe talk about why you might want to use it and, you know, how it would be beneficial? That's why Tallgrass was as successful as it was, because, again, I hired salespeople that were outside the norm in the industry.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you would have been a very, like, rare. There weren't very many women in senior roles altogether, let alone in that kind of industry in those days.
No, not in the early stages. But the interesting thing is that in the late 80s, at our early 90s, just about every president of a Canadian subsidiary of a substantial U.S. firm was a woman.
Huh.
3Com, Tech Data was a competing distributor, had a woman at the helm. Microsoft had a woman at the helm. So it was like the Americans would take their top female executives they were contemplating raising and try them out in a subsidiary operation. So we actually had quite a few women here.
Right.
Europe was a little bit behind. When I went over to run Marisol Europe, I got a phone call from the press saying, how does it feel to be the first woman executive of a computer company? And my answer was, shocking. I had no idea. When I walk into meetings, all the men would stand. And when I go somewhere, they'd all carry my briefcase and stuff. So it took a little adjusting.
That's pretty cool. So is there anything that I should have asked you and I haven't?
No, I don't think so. I think tracking the progress on customer service is important. And I think one of the things we didn't discuss is we did our surveys once a year ourselves, our internal surveys, which were very detailed. But also we were fortunate to have a third-party group. Computer Dealer News was tracking every year as well. And so I think it's important to keep that external view. The internal view gives you more information so you can improve it, but you want to watch that from a third-party tracking point of view, are you doing what you say you're going to do?
So they were looking at perceptions of the overall experience? Or
yeah, they would rank us as the number one. Like, we went from being a distant nothing or eighth to being the number one in customer satisfaction according to the Computer Dealer News surveys.
Interesting. That's a really good point, getting that external perspective. That is a really good point.
If you can.
If you can, for sure. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate this, and I appreciate that you took double time having explained this to me in a very noisy cafe where we couldn't record. But I think this is a really useful, important story to share with people. So thank you.
Thanks, Tamma. My pleasure.
There was a whole lot in this interview that I think is really relevant and important to anyone who wants to turn their organization's customer experience around. One thing I found really interesting was the realization through their research that their competitors were actually competing on something that wasn't the most important thing to the customers. So yeah, their competitors had the reputation of being those who really knew the products well, but they realized after their research that product knowledge wasn't the main thing the customers were after. They had already done their research. What they wanted was to get the products to them quickly. I also liked some of the ideas about using stage tech support And also the realization that timing is a huge factor when it comes to maintaining customer loyalty. So if you mess up, you got to fix it quickly. And their idea of having automated systems with time triggers on them to make sure nothing fell through the cracks is something that I think everybody should be doing. Another thing that really stood out for me was the importance of showing trust. When you have done wrong by a customer, part of the recovery process that can be very effective is saying, we not only accept that we were the ones who messed up, we will trust you to do the right thing if we do the right thing. So, yep, we'll send you that product right away. We won't wait to get your old one back first. First of all, because that helps with the timing, it gets the issue resolved sooner. But also because you're saying to the customers, we really value you and we trust you. Hopefully, you're going to end up returning a bit of that trust. That's all I've got for you today. I look forward to chatting with you again next week. In the meantime, as always, you can reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing A, at frankreactions.com. On Twitter, simply Tema Frank. By telephone, toll-free in North America, 1-866-544-9262. I would really value getting some of your feedback. And if you feel so inclined, it's always wonderful if you'll go over to iTunes and give a review. You can actually sort of do a little shortcut to get there by going to bit.ly/FRiTunes, as in Frank Reactions iTunes. Have a great week.